Home canning is making a comeback. The Wall Street Journal wonders if it's the recession. Some people say it's the local food movement. Support your local growers, which requires a little canning. Other people miss the jams and treats they may remember from childhood. There are canning parties on the web now. Imagine steamy, fragrant kitchens stretching across the country. Our own Linda Wertheimer spent a morning learning the basics of home canning from a food blogger known as Mrs. Wheelbarrow.
Kathy Barrow cans because she loves good food.
I guess it was 4 or 5 years ago I started going to farmers markets 5 times a week. And I get enamored of the food. I can't help myself. And there are only 2 of us, but I come home with enough for 8. And so I had to learn to do something with it.
Why not bag it and freeze it? Surely that's easier.
I have an extra freezer and I have this freezer, but they're always packed.
So, canning. And Kathy Barrow's way is easy to learn. She started us off with something basic, crushed tomatoes, made from very ripe, very big beefsteak tomatoes, chosen for their musky tomato taste.
I want it to be honestly tomato-y. Heirloom tomatoes have that nice variety where some are really acidic and bright and lemony and others are sort of rich and chocolatey. But with crushed tomatoes, I just really want it to taste like a tomato.
Don't be intimidated when I tell you 20 pounds of tomatoes are piled up in the biggest bowl in Kathy Barrow's suburban Washington kitchen. She starts by dunking a few tomatoes at a time in boiling water for 30 seconds, then dropping them in a sink full of water and ice cubes. That makes them easier to peel.
I slice an X in the bottom to help loosen the skin, and then I take the core out. And then the skin should just peel right off.
In 4 great big pieces,
in
it looks like.
4 big pieces.
Then Kathy Barrow gets personal, gets physical with her tomatoes. She takes those big, slippery red globes in 2 hands and squeezes, losing the juice and the seeds in the sink, saving the pulp.
So there's very little moisture in here after I'm done squeezing.
Okay, we're looking at a big stock pot that's about half full of mashed up tomatoes, crushed tomatoes. Now, when you cook them, you're not really going to cook them very much.
No, I'm only going to cook them for 5 minutes, but it will take a little bit to get it up there. So while I squeeze the rest of the tomatoes, I'll get this started.
Once the tomatoes start really boiling, Kathy Barrow sets a 5-minute timer. Would you believe we're almost done?
I want to dispel the notion that it's hard and takes a lot of time to can.
Maybe not time, but it does take stuff. Fortunately, most of it's from the hardware store and not very expensive. You can buy a case of jars, which come with lids that seal, little flat discs with a red ring on the bottom, and rings, the screw-down part. Kathy Barrow boils the lids and rings in a saucepan to sterilize them and then fishes them out of the hot water.
My favorite tool of all is the magnetic lifter. It was 99 cents, and it stopped me from burning my fingers, so that was a good move.
To sterilize the jar, she runs them through the dishwasher. She says that does the trick. Barrow fills those clean jars with hot, crushed tomatoes, leaving 1/2 inch headroom. She puts the lids in place, then screws on the rings.
And I'm just finger-tightening the rings, not super tight.
The jars go into an even larger pot submerged in a boiling water bath. They come out 45 minutes later.
There, look at it. Isn't that beautiful? Wouldn't you like to pull that out in January?
For spaghetti sauce or salsa? Kathy Barrow teaches canning. She blogs about it as Mrs. Wheelbarrow. She collects cookbooks and recipes and lots of equipment, but she says, you can make green tomato refrigerator pickles with no equipment, just jars. She ordered bright green cherry tomatoes from a local farmer, and he brought her 12 pounds.
I said, John, I don't need all of these. He said, I can't sell them. You're going to have to take them. So I'm pickling green cherry tomatoes for the masses. I don't know. I don't know who's going to get them all, but if you're on my Christmas list, you'll be getting these.
She put equal parts vinegar and water on to boil, put a few tablespoons of salt and sugar into each jar, pricked each hard little tomato with a knife, and stuffed them into jars with some extra flavoring.
That was yellow mustard seed, and now I'm going to add some coriander seed, and then some black peppercorn.
What is that?
That's a bay leaf. It's going into each one. It's a very basic pickling mix.
Also into the jar, a little red chili pepper and a peeled clove of garlic.
I want it to be whole because it's so pretty when it floats like that. I think a lot about what the jars look like when they're done. It's not just what's in them, how good it tastes, but I want them to be really pretty, too.
Kathy Barrow pours the boiling brine into the jars of tomatoes. They cool on the counter, then sit in the refrigerator for a week, and they're done. The cherry tomatoes turn from little green golf balls into crunchy, spicy snacks. Learn this recipe, she says, and you can pickle green beans or cauliflower or jalapenos.
I don't think anything could be easier than making a pickle like this.
The most exotic thing we made was French-style fig jam with sliced lemons, spiced with thyme, sweetened with honey. It's Kathy's own invention.
A friend of mine who really hates figs, I mean hates them, said, "My stupid tree is full of fruit. Do you want any?" And I was, yes, and I ran out and picked 4 pounds and then stared at them for several hours while I looked to figure out what to make out of them.
She cuts the figs in half, slices the lemons very thin, sweetens it, and simmers the jam until it starts to thicken. It sits overnight to develop flavors, then she boils it up, packs it into jars that go into that boiling water bath. It's really good.
Do you have a fig tree?
No, actually. But the Truitts next door do.
Perfect. And they go out of town every August, right?
It took about 3 hours to produce jars of crushed tomatoes, refrigerator pickles, beautiful jam, and here's the sound that every home canner loves to hear. That little thunk tells you the lid is airtight, that a morning of hard work has ended with delicious food safely sealed.
The music of the jars. Yeah.
NPR's Linda Wertheimer with home canner Kathy Barrow. You can go to npr.org for links to Mrs. Wheelbarrow's Kitchen and the recipes. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. After more than 2 years of researching and perfecting his recipe, amateur chef Mark Zabel will unveil his latest concoction later this month at the Texas State Fair. You have to be at least 21 years old to eat it because it is fried beer. And he contends that this is the first time anyone has been able to successfully fry a liquid. So, of course, we called him. Mark Zabel, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what's fried beer?
Fried beer is exactly like it sounds. I've taken dough, put beer in it, and deep fried it.
So what do you end up with then? You've got like a kind of a pastry, a jelly donut sort of thing?
You know, I actually right now I'm using them in the form of a ravioli. So it looks just like a ravioli. You bite into it, and it's full of beer.
Meaning that there's a liquid center to it?
It is a liquid center.
And so if you don't bite it carefully, you end up with beer on your shirt.
You will.
And the alcohol content of this is, it's beer.
It is the exact same as if you took it out of a can.
Now, what got you thinking about this?
My wife and I were sitting at a bar and looking at the, appetizer menu, and I saw, nachos and wings and calamari, and I said to her, that's a bunch of boring stuff, and I said, they should have fried beer, and she and I kind of looked at each other and said, that's what we need to come up with for the fair.
Now, what was it about this experiment that took 2 years to get it right?
Putting a liquid into a fryer is a really bad idea. As soon as liquid hits a fryer, it causes it to, spit and boil hot oil everywhere.
Did you suffer any permanent injury?
Nope, no permanent injury, just a few burns here and there.
So how did you successfully fry this liquid?
It was trial and error, and finally, I had even consulted with a food scientist. She couldn't help me figure out a way to do it. It was ultimately something my 4-and-a-half-year-old son was doing that made me think, I can try that, and it worked.
And what was it?
I'm not going to disclose that.
There's a secret recipe, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. Until my patent is, executed, I'm not divulging any information.
So how's it taste?
It tastes great. It tastes just like eating a pretzel with a beer. Currently, I'm using Guinness in my fried beer, so I would say a Guinness goes real well with it.
I mean, is this a snack, or would you see this as more of an entree?
Right now, I see it as like an appetizer snack.
You're in this competition at the Texas State Fair. You've entered your fried beer in this competition. It's a cooking competition. Is there some kind of category that you're in?
No. The Big Tex Cook-Off is actually for the concessionaires that have stands at the fair. They started it 5 years ago. This is the third year that I've entered, and I've been in the finals. You know, it's brought things as deep-fried latte, deep-fried Coke, deep-fried butter from last year. Being a fried food is not a requirement, but nobody's made it into the finals without a fried food.
Now, you said this is just for concessionaires, meaning you were a concessionaire at the Texas State Fair, correct?
I am a carny 3 weeks a year.
A carny. So what were you selling before you had fried beer?
My father started the Belgian Waffle Concession 47 years ago. I took it over around 15 years ago, and we've been doing it ever since. Last year's entry into the finals was sweet jalapeno corn dog shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years ago, my finalist product was chocolate-covered strawberry waffle balls. And, you know, it was funny because I would yell from my stand, I've got your chocolate balls here.
What do you do when you're not being a carny, as you put it?
I'm a corporate recruiter.
Those two things go together surprisingly well, I would think.
Yeah, kind of like oil and beer.
Mark Zabel, thanks very much.
Hey, you're very welcome.
He is entering his fried beer in the Texas State Fair. Many Tea Party activists are drawing inspiration from an unlikely creature. They're telling each other to be more like a starfish and less like a spider. The strengths and weaknesses of those creatures are compared in a business book. Rod Beckstrom is co-author of The Starfish and the Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. How did you first find out that people in the Tea Party movement were recommending your book?
Yeah, you know, we started to see it on Twitter, started to see blog pieces online, and people mentioned it to me. I think it was about a year ago. I mean, early on when the movement started getting going, I think some of the members were first reading the book.
You weren't a Tea Party activist yourself?
No, I was not.
So what did you think when you first heard this?
It made sense. I mean, the book is really a guidebook for people to help organize decentralized movements and organizations of any type.
When you say the starfish and the spider, which is what you say in the title, what do you mean?
Well, what we mean is if we look at these two creatures, superficially they look very similar. They have a lot of arms or legs. But if we dissect them, we see that they're perfectly dissimilar. And in looking at their internal physiology, we get a new model for understanding organizations. If we cut off the leg of an adult spider, we just get a crippled seven-legged spider. But if we cut off the head of the spider, it dies, because it's a centralized organism. Now, that's how we've looked at organizations in the West for the last several hundred years, top-down, spider-like. There's a CEO or there's someone in control. Mm-hmm. But the world is seeing a profusion of new organizations that are a lot more like a starfish. A starfish has between 4 and 50 arms. If you cut off one arm of a starfish, it can regenerate. In some species of starfish, like the blue Lynkea, if you cut off all 5 arms, you get 5 new starfish. That's possible because the starfish is a completely decentralized organism.
Decentralized meaning there's not a brain in there someplace?
It has intelligence, but the intelligence is distributed through each of the arms. When those communicate with each other, they're even more intelligent as a group, but each arm has its own intelligence in it.
So who are some human organizations that you would compare to the starfish?
In the book, we talk about the Apache Indians, a tribe that was incredibly decentralized. And because of how decentralized they were able to withstand the centralized Spanish opponents for literally hundreds of years. So the Apaches, or we talk about the Craigslist community online being highly decentralized and driven by each community individually.
So in what way, if at all, does the Tea Party movement fit this model?
The Tea Party movement fits the model because there's no one in charge, no individual. If you take one unit out, the whole still continues. It is a movement. It has cohesion. The cohesion is around the very term Tea Party, and the cohesion is held through the values, and it is values that hold large decentralized networks together. And in this case, it's the anti-tax values. It's the anti-big government, a set of core values that are held by the different groups.
I wonder if I can just test that notion for a moment. That does sound very exciting if you're a member of a movement like that, and it must be very exciting for members of the Tea Party movement to hold up your book and say, this is what we are. But are you convinced, looking from the outside, that this is entirely a genuine movement and not one that's been generated the way that opposition movements have been sort of generated in the past by people with the money and the connections to do it?
I think there's way too much energy behind this on a sociological sense. I think the impetus was clearly concerns about the economic meltdown and, you know, very aggressive national programs creating concerns in some people. So are there some parties that may have come in and funded it and helped it to shape it or steer it? Absolutely. Is that what gave rise to it? No.
Is it hard to sustain a movement like this? And if so, why?
You know, one of the things that happens, because there's no centralized control and precise definition of what it is or what it's not, there can be a lot of fighting and tearing over time at what does it represent. An example would be I went on the web to research, you know, what are the Tea Party principles? Well, there are no centralized principles. And then there's different chapters and groups and movements that have published their view. As that happens, you're going to see people and parties trying to come in and steer that power or energy into an institution of their liking. That itself creates a process of friction that could lead to diminishment of camaraderie and shared spirit.
Oh, and the more specific that a movement gets about what it wants and who it wants to support, the more likely it is that some people aren't going to agree with the direction the movement's going.
Absolutely. You know, when it starts off with these high-level goals that really almost everyone can agree with, and then it starts, you know, narrowing down things such as, you know, more fiscal responsibility, personal responsibility, rule of law. But the more you get down into the details, then you start getting into fighting lines or debate lines. And so it's going to be very interesting to watch this, to see how it develops. And I don't think this movement's going away for a while. It'll be with us for quite some number of years.
That's Rod Beckstrom, co-author of The Starfish and the Spider. His theory of the starfish gets some people thinking about business, others thinking of sociology, and still others, as we've heard, about politics. It gets us thinking about actual starfish, so we went to visit some. You can find them at the Invertebrate House of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
Up there in the upper right corner, we have what are called purple sea stars, which is kind of odd because they're not actually purple. They're different, more of a beige color.
That's zookeeper Michael Miller.
Starfish have some pretty remarkable things about them.
For one thing, they don't have muscles. Instead, they use a hydraulic system to move around. So let's check that basic statement made by author Rod Beckstrom.
If you cut off one arm of a starfish, it can regenerate.
Zookeeper Michael Miller says that is true, mostly. Most starfish require a part of the central body to remain attached to that arm in order to regenerate. Turns out there are some sea creatures, though, that are even better at survival.
An animal that has, you know, really, really impressive regenerative techniques is a sponge, really. You can take a sponge and literally shove it through a sieve. It individually separates each and every cell, and each of those will cluster back together and form new little sponges all together.
Okay. So now let's examine that other creature that Rod Beckstrom mentioned, the spider.
But if we cut off the head of the spider, it dies.
Turns out that spiders don't technically have heads.
It has two major body segments. It has an abdomen and what we call a cephalothorax, which is kind of a fusion of the head and the thorax region. So they don't have a distinct separate head per se.
That may point to some of the only real flaws in Rod Beckstrom's theory of the spider and the starfish. Beckstrom wants you to consider whether your organization should be more like one or the other. As it turns out, though, neither creature has a backbone or much of a brain.
This year, employers faced moderate increases in health insurance premiums, and they cut themselves a break. According to a new survey, they passed the increases on to their workers, and the new health care law probably isn't going to help matters much. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The good news this year, says Kaiser Family Foundation President and CEO Drew Waltman, is that premiums for employer-provided health insurance stopped rising at their previous double-digit rates.
The overall increase in premiums was moderate, about 3%. And, you know, that's an average across all firms.
But the bad news?
Workers are paying all of that increase. And so the worker contribution to premiums went up 14% this year, and the employer's share did not go up at all.
That added about $482 to the average worker's family premium. Altman says it's the first time in the decade the foundation's been doing the survey he's seen employers literally pass all the increase to their workers. He calls it a survival tactic in a recession-battered economy. But he says that over time, shifting more and more of the cost of insurance to workers is changing the nature of health insurance itself.
Insurance just getting stingier and less comprehensive with more cost sharing and especially with higher deductibles.
Indeed, today more than a quarter of all workers have to pay at least $1,000 before their insurance kicks in. Nearly half of workers in businesses with fewer than 200 employees have deductibles of at least $1,000. Altman says as an employer himself, he's starting to worry.
While certainly some cost sharing is an appropriate part of insurance, too much cost sharing becomes an economic burden for people and a barrier for them to getting the health care that they need.
And he's not the only one. Penny Opalka manages benefits for Snyder's of Hanover, the snack food company. Snyder's actually didn't pass on health insurance increases to workers this year, but it probably will have to next year. And Opalka says loading more cost sharing onto employees is a big concern.
If you have someone who is, say, for instance, earning $9 or $10 an hour, how much can they afford per week to pay out in health care? And that I do think is a challenge and something that many employers are going to be faced with in the future.
Meanwhile, however, Opalka said her company has been faced with growing health costs this year due to another possible link to the recession. They've seen a lot more employees getting a lot more care.
Because of the economy, people just get nervous and they're afraid to put things off till later, and they will actually go in and get something taken care of that maybe they would not have, you know, for this year.
And there's more bad news, says Altman of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is that the new health law won't do much to help the situation.
The politics of health reform were don't touch employer-based health insurance at least very much. And so the law doesn't.
People who find themselves paying more than 9% of their income on employer premiums will be able to seek a better deal in the new insurance exchanges, but everyone else may just have to get used to paying more and getting less. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered. Finally, this hour, take a guess. What year was this song released?
I unpack my chest for you. Do everything that you want me to. Can't believe I give you all my love. What in the world was I thinking of?
1967, maybe? 1971? Well, how about 2010? This song is from the latest album by Lila James. She's a singer whose heart is in a bygone era of American music. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, it's not so easy to be an old soul in a hip-hop world.
Lila James even looks like she belongs in another decade.
She looks like she would be dancing on Soul Train in 1975.
Stephanie Williams, music director of the Tom Joyner Morning Show, is talking about the cover of Lila James' latest CD. James has these white, over-the-knee boots on, and her hair is huge, bigger than Chaka Khan's ever was.
Why you stressing? Why you worry about it? Well, there's a will, there's a way all around it. If you can't change it, just forget all about it. Let it roll. Yeah.
Lila James sounds like the kind of singers Stephanie Williams used to see in smoky clubs in Memphis when she was growing up.
Her voice has this wisdom to it. It's like her voice has lived a life that she has yet to live, you know.
Just let it roll and let it go, let it go. Just let it roll.
This kind of neo-soul is not exactly the stuff radio hits are made of these days. So support from the Tom Joyner Morning Show was a major boost to Lila James' career. Tom Joyner reaches about 8 million people daily, and it's an older crowd. Stephanie Williams says their urban AC, or adult contemporary format, is right for artists like James.
They have to come over to the grown folks' side a lot of times, to the urban AC side, where they can get the exposure, you know, that they need, and grown people can listen to grown people's music without, you know, the hip-hop and the things we have out there right now on our kids' iPods.
Lila James says most of the rest of the people in the music business haven't known what to do with her. In 2005, she was signed to Warner Brothers, a major label. It started out well. Her first CD was a tribute to some of the soul stars of the 1960s and 70s. In her song, Music, she names some of her heroes, Aretha, Chaka, Gladys.
Somebody play on the guitar strings. Makes me think of my favorite song. Reminds me when I heard Aretha sing, Gladys, Tina, and Chaka Khan. We can't go back to yesterday, but can we just put the thongs away?
We can't go back to yesterday, but can't we just put the thongs away? Lila James.
You don't have to be butt naked in your videos or whatever, sell your soul to sell a record.
For other artists, being on a major label would have been a triumph. But for James, it didn't turn out that way.
They didn't really know what to do with me. You know, I'm a soul singer, black artist, and Warner really wasn't known for that type of music.
Lila James' new CD is on Stax, a smaller label that was once home to such soul icons as the Staple Singers and Otis Redding.
Stax, being that it's a legendary soul label, the whole process of recording the album in itself was like smooth sailing. They get it. They get, I mean, that's, they get a soul voice.
'Cause when you leave me, babe, I'm thinking about you always. I'm ashamed to say how much I want you to
Stax has been pretty much dormant since the early 1980s, until the Concord Music Group bought the label in 2004 and relaunched it. A spokesperson for the company said they'd like to help artists develop their careers rather than chase hit-driven radio formats. But Lila James says she'd be just fine with a radio hit. And here's another challenge for a soul artist in the 21st century. It's hard to top those great songs from the 1960s and 70s.
You take a Al Green record like or something by Marvin Gaye, when you hear those timeless records, it's not too much that can compare to that kind of stuff.
So Lila James doesn't mind doing covers of those songs in her concerts. No doubt she'll do some tonight when she performs at the Tom Joyner Family Reunion in Orlando. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
It's been a long time coming, but I know.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair left office 3 years ago, but his decision to support the war in Iraq is still very much with him. In a new memoir called A Journey, Blair says he continues to study the war and even gather evidence about it. Just this year, he testified before a British panel investigating the war. He was asked if he regrets his decision to fight. Blair writes that he could not answer yes or no. His opponents would attack him either way. He had to sidestep the issue, which led to another question when he visited our studios. What is the word that would describe your feelings about this war?
I don't know that there is a word as such. I think that probably I would characterize it by saying you can't be sure yet how people will look back on this. Hopefully, Iraq will stabilize. But truthfully, what was problematic is what's problematic in Afghanistan today. It's what's problematic in many parts of the world, which is this extremist ideology that is prepared to use terror in order to disrupt and destabilize. And that is an immensely difficult thing to deal with.
And I want to talk about that a little more in a minute. But I'm curious, if regret is not a fair word to ask you to attach or deny, I'm just wondering what word is a fair word?
Well, regret, as I say in the book, You would be inhuman if you didn't feel, you know, devastated by the loss of life and by the people that have died, our soldiers, your soldiers, the civilians. But you can't say I regret a decision if you actually think it was the right decision. You know, in a sense, when people want you to sum up in a word, what they want you to do is sum up in a headline something that, in my judgment, isn't really susceptible, either emotionally or politically, of being summed up in a word or a headline.
Would you describe for people a letter from an Iraqi woman that you say you have kept in your desk all these years.
Yes, this was someone who came to see me before the Iraq conflict. And I remember sitting in Downing Street, up in the drawing room in Downing Street, and her explaining to me how her family had been tortured and killed by Saddam and how the country was crying out for release from Saddam. And then after May 2003, when Saddam was toppled, she went back to Iraq. And then a few months later, sectarians killed her. And as I say in the book, you know, what would she say to me now? And that's, I think, the question that's why I say it's not very easy to make this judgment right now. What would she say? I don't know.
What do you make of that? Because you could have received thousands of letters like that. There are thousands of stories like that.
There are thousands of stories like that. And the question is, as one Iraqi put it to me, but why do we have to have a choice between rule by Saddam or rule by terror? Why can't we have what you have? They actually would prefer governments that they elect and a rule of law they can rely on. And why shouldn't they? But one of the things I say in the book, and I really believe very passionately, is the West got to, after everything that's happened, the financial crisis, the security issues we face, we should still have confidence in our own way of life. It is actually the way of life that most people in the world aspire to if they had the chance.
You also write about the battle of different narratives when it comes to the battle against terrorism. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is, we've got to get ourselves out of the position in the West of believing we are causing this terrorism. Or when these people drive car bombs into whether it's Baghdad or Kabul, that somehow this is something we have caused.
That's a narrative you're talking about and that you write about that a lot of people in the Islamic world will accept, that the West has oppressed Muslims, has backed up corrupt governments, mm-hmm. and that leads to terrorism and may even justify terrorism. That's the narrative you're talking about.
Yeah, and that narrative, unfortunately, stretches even into parts of our own way of thinking.
What's wrong with it?
It's just wrong.
Are parts of it true?
No. I don't think, frankly, any part of it's true. I can tell you back in the UK, Muslims have the right of freedom of worship to a degree that in many Muslim countries they can't exercise. You know, people are free in our countries.
A little bit earlier this year, a former head of MI5, British Intelligence Service, gave testimony about the war in Iraq, in which she said that war, or perhaps we should say the narrative of that war, radicalized many Muslims inside Britain and outside Britain to turn against the West. Did the decision to go to war in Iraq, the inevitable decision to have Westerners killing Muslims with the inevitable propaganda that would be made of that, turn out to be counterproductive?
First of all, let's just be clear. The majority of people that have died in Iraq have died actually Muslim-on-Muslim violence, right? In reality, the issue is this. There are two competing strains of thought within Islam. One is modernizing, sensible, that says, look, in the end, Islam's problems are for Islam to sort out, and we will sort them out, and we're going to embrace the 21st century. The other is a narrative that is about a victimization by the West and leaders that are complicit with the West, that is a narrative that leads, in the end, to conflict.
What would you do to get your narrative a little more strength?
Well, let's have the sort of good news rather than the bad news, as it were. I think this extremism that we're facing, it's more like, to me, it's more like something like revolutionary communism. In other words, you know, it's a global ideological movement, but it will take a generation to confront and to knock out. But in the end, the only way of defeating it is with a better idea. And that better idea is one that many people are articulating, actually, in the Arab countries that I see now. There's big process of modernization, even a country like Saudi Arabia. I mean, its king is taking, you know, really brave decisions, pushing the country forward. And so there are these modernizing forces there, and we've got to be there with them.
You mentioned the analogy with the Cold War, with fighting communism, which was a political system, but basically an economic argument. This is a better, fairer economic system. And it was very easy for the West to counter that simply by pointing out, we're richer than you are. Everybody is healthier than you are. We have more stuff. We have blue jeans. We have things that you would like. Is it harder to make, in effect, a religious or moral argument? Because this is a religious movement you're fighting.
No, it's not harder, but it's worth remembering. Back in the 1950s, if you recall, it wasn't so obvious that the economics all went the West's way. It became obvious later. There were many people, in your country and in my country, who basically thought, look, we don't like the repression of the Soviet system, but nonetheless, economically, they can deliver greater benefits to people. So it took quite a time, actually, for the economic argument to come through. Today, this is why it's so important to counter, at a religious, I know it sounds an odd thing to say, but at a religious level, as well as at a political level, an ideology that says, I have the true path to salvation. Anyone who doesn't agree with me is basically an infidel. And we are engaged in what is, in some senses, a similar notion of saying, no, there is actually a different way of looking at the world, which is to say, I'm a Christian, you're a Muslim or a Jew, but we don't have to triumph over you and you don't have to triumph over us in the religious sphere. We can coexist together.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is the author of a memoir, A Journey, My Political Life. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Find a link to excerpts of Blair's book on Twitter. Go to NPR Inskeep. It's NPR News.